In 2012, the planet Venus will pass directly between the Sun and the Earth. This transit of Venus won't occur again until the year 2117. My name is Troy Klein, and welcome to Sun-Earth Day 2012, Shadows of the Sun. Many of our NASA missions play an enormous part in telling that incredible story, the story of our dynamic solar environment. In this podcast, we'll continue our series about the RESI mission with Dr. Gordon Emsley. Gordon is on the Physics Astronomy Faculty at Western Kentucky University in Bowling Green, Kentucky. The thrust of the bulk of his research for the last 30 years or so has been the study of energy release and transport in solar flares, with emphasis on the diagnostics provided by hard X-ray observations, both spectra, images, and polarization. Most recently, this project has been fueled with the exciting new imaging spectroscopy data from the RESI satellite. To get started, I asked Gordon to tell us more about why he studies solar flares.
I study solar flares not only because they're intrinsically interesting, but also because they reveal all kinds of basic physics that go on in other sources. We try and understand the process by which high-energy particles are accelerated, for example. The Sun is a wonderful laboratory to do this. The Sun is 8 light minutes away. The nearest competitor or nearest star is 4 light years away. Now, this interview segment may take 8 minutes, but it's a huge difference between looking at something that's that close. You can study processes in exquisite detail and hopefully take the lessons learned and apply them to other scenarios in the universe. Not only is the Sun, I say this rather close, it's 8 light minutes away, it also turns out to have one of the highest brightnesses per unit weight, if you like, of any of these, you know, very powerful sources. People speak about active galactic nuclei, gamma ray bursts, and certainly they are more energetic overall than a solar flare. But per pound, a solar flare actually wins. You get a tremendous amount of energy out of a very compact region of the Sun. And it's understanding that will be key to understanding processes in other objects as well.
I asked Gordon to tell us more about the prediction of solar flares and how understanding those processes can help us here on Earth.
Well, there's several ways of answering that question. I think before you can predict anything, you have to understand it. I'll use an analogy to hurricanes. A hurricane prediction has come a long way, not only because we now have satellite pictures, we can see them form and move, but also because we know we understand a little better the processes of hurricane formation. For example, whether hurricanes develop over warm water or cool water, and it's a fundamental understanding of the processes involved in establishing a hurricane helps us predict whether they'll grow in intensity or not. So it's the same thing. We're a long way away from understanding solar flares well enough to predict them, much as you would predict the weather forecast terrestrially. But it's a necessary first step. Being able to predict these, of course, has immediate applications for the Sun-Earth system, space weather. Solar flares, sufficiently large ones, can create all kinds of disruptions to your daily life. The cell phones that were causing interference in this conversation just five right. minutes ago, you can have widespread disruption of cell phone signals due to atmospheric electromagnetic effects in the Earth's atmosphere induced by a solar flare. They produce very pretty things like the aurora borealis, northern lights, but on occasions they've knocked out entire power grids. In the late 80s in southeast Canada, was totally without power for several days because of a solar flare that interacted with the Earth's magnetic field, creating voltages that destroyed a large section of a power grid. So there are very obvious implications of these events. Now, while we can't stop them, we can at least give warnings, much as you would give a tornado warning or hurricane warning.
So how did Dr. Emsley get interested in astronomy and physics in the first place? Was there a particular event or specific person in his life that had the most influence?
My interest in astronomy in general started when I was age 6. And my grandfather gave me a book called Frontiers of Astronomy by Fred Hoyle. This is not the typical book you give to a six-year-old. It has equations in it, it has all kinds of diagrams, but it enunciated very clearly how we could actually tell what the inside of a star looked like. And that, to a six-year-old, is fascinating because we've never been there. You can never go there. But through thinking about it, you can actually learn fairly unequivocally what the inside of a star looks like. When I went to university, they asked me what I wanted to major in. I said physics, and they said, well, what else? And I said, well, I looked at the list and there was astronomy. And they said, oh, no, it's very difficult, this astronomy. You won't be looking at stars and things. It's got lots of equations and things, and it's very, very difficult, which was exactly what I wanted to hear. So I signed up for astronomy. One of the professors that taught that course was John Brown. He's now the Astronomer Royal for Scotland, and was my thesis advisor. And through his work, I got involved in the solar physics community, starting with a trip I made to the United States in 1976. I like to tell people that if the internet had existed in 1976, I'd probably still be in Scotland. But in those days, if you needed access to data, and in my case, it was data from the Skylab Observatory, you had to go where the data was. The data was in the filing cabinet in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So that got me across the pond. I told people I was going for the summer. It's been a long summer. Never really went back.
Towards the end of our conversation, I asked Gordon if he would share some parting advice with our listeners.
As a professor, I've worked with many, many students. And it takes a lot of students a long time to realize that we don't actually know the answer. A lot of the college experience is about what I would call getting the answer in the back of the book. And you know, you get verification that you have indeed learned the material correctly and you got the right answer and you got a point for that. Research isn't like that. You have to have enough faith in the answer that you just obtained. You have to cross-check it with other things. You have to change things a little bit to see if the answer moves in the direction you would expect it to move. So there's all this kind of like self-testing with really no absolute verification that you're right. You build up a sense of growing confidence that you have the correct answer. A lot of my research in connection with RESI involves mathematical manipulation of observations from the spacecraft. And I find it fascinating that you do get answers sometimes that you can independently verify, and those answers you get much more confidence in when you can relate it to other things, and when you see them match up, that's a wonderful experience, because not only do you realize that you did in fact get the answer right, but you've added to the store of knowledge that other people have produced as well.
At the end of the interview, Gordon and I continued to talk about the importance of gathering data from a variety of sources when conducting research.
Right now, in solar physics, we have, of course, many satellites observing the sun and gamma rays, X-rays, optical, UV, and I find it still, to this day, fascinating that when you put up an image of the sun in all these different colors, that they match. So there really must be something truly going on there. We are actually observing the sun and not some artifact of the instrumentation.
Yeah, all of the different instruments verify each other's stories.
They corroborate each other.
That's right. And we have our students who go out with sunspotters and then they'll go look at the space weather media viewer on their computers and they're always shocked. They're like, wow, the sunspot we just saw and recorded is exactly the same one that just came down from the NASA satellites.
Absolutely.
And the satellites that are in space.
Well, absolutely. We all live in the same universe. We all observe it in our own way, and the aggregation of mankind's knowledge. Knowledge is very easy these days. I mean, information is very easy. You Google it. It's the synthesis of that information into a coherent understanding of phenomenon that is what research is about, and that's why I do it.
We'd like to thank Dr. Emsley for taking the time to talk with us today and look forward to future podcasts about the RESI mission. You can find all of the information about this year's theme, Shadows of the Sun, on the Sun Earth Day website at sunearthday.nasa.gov. We'll continue to populate that website with the latest information about our upcoming programs, background resources, activities, and registration information. With the help of our friends from the Solar Dynamics Observatory mission, we've even included a new events-based Google Map. One of our main goals is to help you join thousands of people in learning more about the transit of Venus on June 5th and 6th of 2012, and then again for a total solar eclipse on November 13th and 14th, 2012. Upcoming podcasts will include interviews with additional NASA scientists, astronomers, educators, and media specialists from the award-winning NASA EDGE team. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter to join in on the discussion with our growing Sun Earth Day community. For all other details about the Sun Earth Day program, including information about our past Sun Earth Day themes, be sure to visit our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov. While there, don't forget to register in order to receive Sun Earth Day updates. You can learn more about NASA by simply visiting www.nasa.gov.
This is Troy Klein signing off.